Packet Pushers.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Packet Protector, the podcast at the intersection of security and networking from the Packet Pushers. I'm JJ, and I'm here with Drew Conry-Murray. And today we're going to talk about hardware supply chain risk and how to mitigate them with a guest, Paul Assadorian. Several of you guys, I'm sure, listening know who Paul is. He's currently the principal security evangelist for Eclipsium. And he's also, of course, the founder of Security Weekly and host of Paul's Security Weekly podcast. But guys, before we get into the hardware supply chain conversation, let's check on some of the news headlines. The first one that was really kind of standing out to me this week is, if you guys are in the U.S., you've heard about this. If you're outside the U.S., you might have. Tuesday, so March 26th this week, 1:30 in the morning, the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore collapsed after a Singapore-based cargo ship lost control and plowed into a bridge support column at about 8 knots, which is pretty quick. The bridge, which is about a quarter mile or 350 meters long, completely collapsed in a matter of seconds following that impact. And they're investigating, but they think from the Mayday call that the ship was leaving the port, that it lost power, and therefore it lost its navigation control. And a lot of us are sitting here wondering, is that exactly what happened? Could the cargo ship have lost power because it was hacked in some way, intentionally or inadvertently? And if not this time, what are the chances of that happening? What are going to be the consequences? Is this going to give perhaps our adversaries some ideas about ways to impact our infrastructure? Lots of follow-on from this. And Drew, Paul, you know, rolling back several years, we've kind of had this attack on the maritime infrastructure and ports for, you know, six-ish years at this point. So 2016-17 is when we started seeing different reports about attacks like this.
Yeah, I was at the outset very suspicious of people saying, is this cyber? This could be cyber, that, because it just seemed like kind of paranoia. And I still feel like, you know, the most simple explanation is some kind of operational fault on board the ship that cut the power, as opposed to a deliberate cyber attack.
Yeah, having worked with technology for a long time, I often find we try to blame hackers. And usually it's your technology has just failed in some way, right? So I think that's likely the case here, although I do think it gives people ideas, which is kind of dangerous in terms of disrupting our, you know, delicate supply chain infrastructure, especially when just even talking about shipping goods and services. So
yeah, I guess I feel like obviously there are weaknesses in our system that can be exploited, but supply chain attacks like this also have effects on, you know, people who we consider our adversaries, like China, because they're the ones doing most of the exporting. So anything that slows down our ability to take in and process those goods also hurts them.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, yeah.
I was thinking the same thing. They want to get the goods here because, you know, that's part of their economy. So
it's definitely like cutting off your nose to spite your face kind of a thing. That said, you know, if we ever get into, you know, more of a hot war, things like this potentially could happen. But again, I think the most reasonable response is this was probably just an electrical failure. Although, JJ, you do note that there has been some concerns about port security in general, especially around, I guess, there are Chinese manufactured cranes that are used in lots of ports in the US and all over the world. And some of them turned out to have cellular modems that weren't requested or expected in these cranes. And that seemed like, was this on purpose? Is this a potential backdoor into these systems? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I definitely have concerns about that, you know, working in critical infrastructure. I'm curious what Paul's thoughts are here in a second, but that's not a warm, fuzzy feeling when you find out that there's something that has, you know, remote communication capability, and especially cellular, because it's a lot harder for most organizations to detect without, you know, special tooling to do that. It wasn't only not requested, it was specifically not requested. And the company who provided those cranes has a long history with the Chinese communist government proper, as well as it is also co-located with some of the Chinese defense facilities. So there's like this long domino effect of things that don't look good and sort of bad signals tied around the company that supplied the chains. So it's definitely concerning to me. This also sort of bubbled up. It's been going on for a few years. It kind of bubbled up around the same time as we're finding that, you know, the Chinese have had persistence of like 5 years in infrastructures like customer equipment, ISP devices that are logically and physically adjacent to a lot of these other critical infrastructure connections. And so that's also just the timing looks very bad.
Yeah, it's super hard to validate what's inside of a device to look for this kind of thing. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's more resource issue, right? If I'm a company and I'm bringing in, you know, 1,000 of these devices, I want something that's going to run on these devices and audit the firmware and hardware and software that's on it to tell me things like, hey, did you know that there was a cellular modem inside here? If we were to interrogate the device, we could probably determine that. And I think that's where we need to be. But I think we're very resource constrained because doing that on a lot of these devices is very time intensive and requires research.
Let me ask you, because, you know, these cranes are huge. They're not the normal cranes you see, you know, pulling building pieces up as you drive down the highway. They're giant port cranes. And, you know, I mean, cellular devices can be tiny, you know, of less than inches in size. I mean, especially for something that's not communicating constantly, if it's, you know, just kind of coming on every once in a while, how do they find that unless you have some type of RF monitoring? Well, we're going to get into this in a minute with supply chains. Are there ways to find electronics that are not meant to be and not expected on a device?
I mean, I would hope that this communications device in this example is connected to the computer that drives the crane that you could interrogate and evaluate to say, hey, on this, you know, computer that controls this physical thing, there's this extra communications device. We should be able to pick up on that. I'm not sure of the architecture of cranes, but I know in a lot of other cases, right, we're looking at the interrogating the hardware going, what's inside this thing, to go, that's not what I expected, right? So there's a lot of work on both sides of suppliers and consumers to get that done. From an RF perspective, yeah, that gets tricky, monitoring all of that RF.
Yeah, it's a lot of spectrum recovery.
Yeah.
All right, in similar news, there's a new acoustic side channel attack on some keystroke detection, which was interesting because we've seen a series of these sort of side channel attacks with different mechanisms of sort of monitoring in order to derive keystrokes. Researchers have published a new paper, actually, because not to be confused with one that came out a little bit ago that was high accuracy. So a new method for acoustic side channel attacks in which they analyze the sound waveforms of keystrokes to determine the keystroke's timing, intensity, and frequency, exposing sensitive information.
Yeah, this is an interesting paper. The researchers were able to pretty accurately predict a user's keystroke, you know, 43% of the time on average, they say, without requiring a specific model of keyboard to be used, without eliminating ambient noise, although their test did assume only one person in a private office, but still they weren't controlling for the regular noise that you generate in an office. And they collected the sound of these keyboards using the built-in microphone on the subject's computer rather than, you know, high-end or specialized audio equipment. So, you know, basically using the stuff that you would find in someone's office to capture the acoustics of these keystrokes and then put them into an algorithm to see if they could then determine what was being typed.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of the attack, because if I compromise one computer, I mean, I could just install a keystroke logger on it. But if there's another computer in the office with a keyboard on it that's maybe not connected to the internet or I can't access as an attacker, I can potentially get those keystrokes as well. So that makes this attack, you know, somewhat interesting. We see these all the time, all the different ways to create these covert channels using some kind of side channel. You know, we've covered them over the years. The fans, you know, can make noise. The LED blinking lights, like there's a million ways to do that. One of the interesting attacks that we covered that I think is probably you need to pay attention to more than these covert channels is one is mouse jacking. So that attack was publicized in 2016, but it's still happening today. I read an article where on a pen test using a Flipper Zero with an add-on, they were able to inject a payload, you know, over a vulnerable mouse or keyboard dongle. So we need to make sure we get those out of our environment or update the firmware on them. And then there's been some new Bluetooth attacks. One does the keystroke injection over Bluetooth. So very similar to mouse jacking, but on Bluetooth. I think I actually call it bluejacking. And the other is Blue Spy, which lets you intercept the communications between your computer and your Bluetooth headset. So there's been some new research in the Bluetooth area that I find interesting.
Bluetooth is an ever growing snowball of dumpster fire.
Yes.
Yeah. I was just looking. So this, I came from a SIGINT family. And this kind of reminded me of, like, you know, all of these side channel attacks remind me of sort of the Tempest collection of intelligence gathering that have been prevalent for, I mean, many, many decades at this point. So always interesting. I don't have immediate fears and concerns about this particular attack. I mean, 43% accuracy is not high. It is high considering not really needing special equipment, keyboard, et cetera.
Yeah, they did have to collect samples from their test subjects as well first to have sort of a dictionary of words of how they typed them. So that also adds to the difficulty.
Don't think that would be too hard, but I would be concerned if you had that coupled with a mobile device that had been compromised, because now you just have a microphone running around, you know, probably on the person or with the person, whatever they're doing, and getting that access sort of persistently.
Yeah, it's an interesting paper. And they talked a little bit about countermeasures, and I'm probably dating myself with this reference, but it makes me think of the cone of silence from Get Smart.
Yes.
Drew, leave it to you to pull out a Get Smart reference.
I love it.
Do I just need to type quieter now? Is that what I'm doing here?
Oh my God. Wow. Flashbacks there. Well, kind of continuing this hardware conversation, let's pull Paul in a little more deeply and talk about the meat of this. So we've talked about supply chain. We talked about how that's typically for most of us, you know, I think in network engineering, we're like, yeah, whatever. That's a policy, paperwork, procurement problem. Not my problem. Not my circus. Not my monkeys. But there is an entire ecosystem around validating infrastructure integrity. And there's some, you know, Paul gave an example of, hey, we could actually look at the, you know, computer driving the crane and start to examine the things, you know, inputs and outputs going in it, make sure that nothing is happening that shouldn't be and everything that should be happening is happening. And so Drew and I were talking a couple of weeks ago and, you know, sort of thinking through a couple of scenarios that this might be appropriate for. And I think we were thinking technology manufacturers, you know, your typical networking infrastructure, Cisco, Juniper, HP, blah, blah, blah. You know, they've contracted with manufacturing facilities around the world typically, and they need to validate those completed systems have been built and then assembled to spec and don't have, you know, extra little bits in them. And of course, in the federal side, we've got TAA compliant things where we do some additional checking. And then also, I'm just assuming, you know, some of the large organizations out there, you know, data centers, DOD, large financial organizations like probably, you know, the Bank of America's of the world, Meta's, Google's, Amazon's, NVIDIA, Microsoft. These organizations, and especially those that are developing AI technologies, can't really afford any type of leaking or extra help, I'm air quoting, right, in those devices, those hardware devices. And then I think you had also kind of talked about, Drew, counterfeit components.
I think most folks in the networking space are probably going to run into counterfeits probably more than tampered devices, but it is part of that, you know, supply chain question.
So, Paul, are these the primary use cases for this type of additional validation and testing?
Yeah, absolutely. And the challenge we have right now is gaining that visibility into these devices or boxes that we purchase, and we drop them in our networks or, you know, wherever in our organization. And I think right now we just have this inherent trust that the device is what it says it is, and it's going to do what it says it's supposed to do, and everything's going to be fine, when we really need to not trust that device, right? We need to validate and then trust. And that validation takes different shapes and forms, but it's an important step to validate. Is the firmware that it says it's running really the firmware from the manufacturer, right? Or has it been tampered with? And then we couple that integrity checking with also vulnerabilities as well. In fact, Cisco just released a patch for one yesterday or today to fix a secure boot validation vulnerability, right? So with those types of vulnerabilities, now an attacker can modify firmware and get that system to boot it, and you wouldn't be the wiser unless, you know, you had some tooling to catch those particular scenarios.
So what are the risks then of a device that's purposely tampered with, say, at a manufacturing facility? Is it putting in some kind of backdoor to exfiltrate information or something else?
Typically, right? It would maintain persistence is one thing, right? It's one thing to get in from the front door, if you will, where you're likely to be caught and then, you know, do the remediation and wipe it out. But in the terms of the firmware being tampered with, those can persist across reboots, across, you know, wipes. We've seen attackers get inside your backup files of your various appliances. So even if you wipe the appliance, that malicious code gets put back, typically calls back home. And I think the trend that we're seeing now is it's being used as a jumping off point, particularly for ransomware, to get into an Active Directory environment, for example, is a lot of what we see attackers using this type of thing for.
Now, that's an interesting twist I didn't see. Can you connect those dots for me? So they're going through hardware exploits to then use that as a pivot point into Active Directory?
Yeah, a lot of it's happening in VPN and firewall appliances that have that connection to Active Directory in some way. And so gaining access to that device, you start getting your hooks into Active Directory, and they're using that access to ransomware like they would if they got into a Windows device. But they're banking on these VPNs and firewalls, as an example, are connected to the internet and contain vulnerabilities, and they're hard to patch, right? Patching means downtime and planning. And that's why today you see a lot of these devices that have remotely exploitable critical vulnerabilities. And, you know, CISA has said these are being exploited in the wild in the Kev. And then we do the research, or someone looks on the internet, they're like, oh, there's still 10,000 vulnerable devices on the internet, right? Because they're hard to patch. We trust that this appliance thing should come from the manufacturer secure when it's not.
So how common then are these firmware vulnerabilities? Like, I understand we're dealing with a lot of vulnerabilities in the operating system and the application software. Yeah, it tends to be riddled. But firmware, it seems like you should have some control over that at the manufacturing level.
Yeah, a lot of manufacturers don't ship, newsflash, they don't ship firmware securely, right? And that's been a trend for a long time. I mean, it's why I work where I work today, because I've been just kind of enamored with firmware throughout my career, because it always seems like that dusty corner that no one pays attention to. Right? You typically don't interact with firmware until you have a problem, right? We just kind of trust that that low-level code that's enabling the hardware is just going to work. And we focus on the stuff that we can see and interact with until we have a problem. And then we go, oh, we need to update firmware. And then we all get really scared and worried because of the operational risk. You can easily brick a device. You can easily cause downtime, you know, with some of these firmware updates. So.
And so many of those updates, I mean, just coming again from like the traditional on-prem infrastructure manufacturers, a lot of them, even if you were trying to do your due diligence and maintain it properly, they don't even support secure file transfer protocols. You basically have to temporarily enable something like FTP or TFTP to get either config files or firmware if you're manually downloading it into that device, and then you can step it back up. The firmware itself is one thing, but then there's these other pieces that they just kind of suck at as well that's related to maintaining the integrity of that firmware.
Yeah. And I mean, this greatly varies across many different types of devices. But I think in general, actually conversations I've had recently with people thinking about how do we get better at remediating firmware vulnerabilities in our organizations, and it comes down to making that process easy, right? If we have to go enable a protocol, then do the thing and disable the protocol, and it's, you know, it can be a nightmare to get these things updated. But it's, in my mind, the critical path, right, that we have to fix these vulnerabilities, because attackers are going to go after it, right? Attackers go after devices and firmware because we may not be paying attention to them as much as we do our Windows systems, right? They can fly under the radar. They can maintain persistence. And these systems are typically vulnerable. You've got a small space to put that code in. There's a lot of code reuse in firmware, and the management interfaces are typically pretty terrible.
Is this what you've described here related to, I mean, we've seen all of the vendors, I'm not going to pick on any one, but I'm going to bring up Barracuda, because that was the first time I had seen the recommendation, take it out. We saw that recommendation later, right, with Ivanti and some other things.
Yes.
But that was the first time I had seen a recommendation come, is not patch it, not this, not change config, not put some mitigating control around it, take it out. Was that related, or could it have been related to this type of vulnerability?
I think so. I wish I had like some definitive proof of what was happening in that, you know, attack chain to cause that. Short of that, I mean, I just have theories, right? And I'll use the UEFI analogy. If an attacker is able to get on the spy flash chip where your UEFI firmware lives, it can be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get rid of that malicious code at that level. And so my guess is, in the cases that you mentioned, attackers were embedded deep in the firmware, and therefore the recommendation was you got to wipe it or get rid of it entirely, right? I spoke about that at ShmooCon almost 2 years ago or a year and a half ago about permanently bricking systems, right? So there's the, I can live in your system and it doesn't matter what you do, right? I'm going to live inside of your system until you get rid of the hardware. But there's also, with that low level access, if I want to cause destruction, that's certainly possible. You know, there's research papers that support you can cause physical damage to something with a firmware-based attack.
So how then do I test firmware? Is this something that I can do in my organization, or I need to go to a third party? And then how does the third party do it?
I hate to like just blatantly promote my day job. It is what we do at Eclipsium. And I do write about and research the, you know, kind of manual methods, right? I mean, that's a lot of what we do, is manually pulling apart firmware, trying to create an SBOM off of that firmware, trying to look at the various components inside of that firmware, reverse engineer it to find vulnerabilities, whether that's binary or static analysis. And it tends to be very time consuming and, you know, takes a great deal of technical skill. And that's where a lot of tooling is coming along to help you do that, right? There's projects like Emba, for example, is an open source project that you can give firmware and it'll automatically pull it apart, look for vulnerabilities, tell you about vulnerable libraries, look for new vulnerabilities in code using static analysis, and things like that.
I have a question. What total gut check, like just off the cuff, if you had to guess based on the population you've seen of these situations, what rough percentage is actually malicious, like this was put there on purpose versus just poor coding design out the gate from something?
Yeah, usually it's a vulnerability or configuration mistake that just happened, right? It wasn't that someone actually tampered with it and put a backdoor through the supply chain. Most of the time, there is a vulnerability or configuration mistake. Then, and it, once it's deployed, an attacker will take advantage of that to embed themselves inside of the firmware.
And what about like all of the different hooks that the manufacturers have for different diagnostic, either through the manufacturing process or as QA? You know, afterwards, is I've heard a couple of like one-off stories about some of the vulnerabilities related to those sort of, because they're kind of backdoors into that device. Typically, is that common? Yeah. Or
I am seeing it being less common, right? In one particular case, for example, in Intel-based systems, there's a what's called manufacturing mode. So we've seen over time. So that's a process where, as you were describing, JJ, right, the manufacturing process happens and there's a lot of debugging and system configuration that has to happen. That should all culminate in the case of like a PC, laptop, or server with turning off manufacturing mode, right? With manufacturing mode on, the manufacturer is supposed to write keys to certain chips that are not supposed to be changed, right? And close off those circuits, basically, is how it works. And there have been cases over time where manufacturers haven't closed out manufacturing mode, which means if an attacker gets on the system, they can write, you know, new keys to that and load whatever firmware they want, bypassing any kind of checks, such as a secure boot.
We're pausing the conversation for a brief reminder that Packet Pushers has a Slack community, and you can join for free. Whether you want to ask questions, share tech tips, swap stories, or just connect with other engineers, the Slack community is a friendly, collegial space. Check it out at packetpushers.net/slack. That's packetpushers.net/slack. And now back to the show.
And I gave some of the examples Drew and I came up with like network infrastructure, but it sounds like this actually, rightly so, would extend down to servers, endpoints, you know, pretty much anything that's critical.
Yeah. And so like when I say secure boot, like I reference Cisco and secure boot, to my knowledge, I don't believe that's UEFI secure boot. So a lot of these network appliances for network gear, for example, the manufacturer will implement their own secure boot process, meaning when that device loads the bootloader and the firmware, it's doing some kind of cryptographic check to make sure that it actually came from the manufacturer. And there's bypasses for various manufacturers. UEFI defined the global standard for mostly PCs, right, and servers and laptops to do secure boot.
That manufacturer mechanism to check to load, you know, based on some cryptographic information, is that the TPM trusted platform module that you're talking about or something like that?
Some of it will use a TPM either separate from the CPU or on the CPU to store those. I have a blog post I wrote called like Keys to the Kingdom, and it talks about all the different keys and where they're stored and what they're used for, because it's confusing, right? And when we look at the supply chain, like my whole thing was we need to evangelize this, because we talk about vulnerabilities in software and we talk about malicious code being in firmware and the supply chain that gives us our hardware, firmware, and software. But I'd like to think of it as like a different, there's a supply chain for your keys, right? For your cryptographic keys that are doing all of this validation for BootGuard, for secure boot, and all these different mechanisms. And if a key gets lost, which has happened, right? And the other half of that key, let's say, is burned onto the board, you're going to get new hardware, right? If there are certain keys that control the secure boot processes for like every system running Windows, for example, God forbid Microsoft were to lose keys. Like, we have these conversations at work sometimes. Like, what would happen if Intel or Microsoft were to lose that key? That would be a bad day for a lot of people. Now, thankfully, Intel and Microsoft do a fantastic job of protecting these keys. I don't know how they protect them, because they're not going to tell us that, as they shouldn't, right?
Those keys, maybe not so great with some of the other keys.
Right, yes. And there's different keys for all the different mechanisms. So, and Microsoft is doing this whole refresh on a lot of their keys for secure boot as well.
And I haven't dug into it, but I know in the last day or two, Apple, there's a vulnerability related, and I don't know the details because I haven't read it yet, but there's some issues, vulnerability around the way some of the apps within Apple are handling keys. I don't know if anybody's looked at that yet, but if not, something to check out.
Yeah, I haven't heard on the app side. Apple's another one that they have their own secure boot process. And they protect their hardware and firmware in a proprietary way. They actually hired some really smart people that were breaking firmware, one of them being Zeno Kova, worked for Apple for a while and helped develop that. So it's a pretty robust system from, you know, what I've gathered.
So you've kind of described some of the firmware issues. Are there times that there might also be hardware that has, you know, components and pieces of, you know, the cellular modem on a crane is sort of one type of example, but obviously that piece of equipment could be ordered with that for remote maintenance and monitoring. But, you know, is there opportunity to slip in some components that are on the hardware side, not sort of spec'd, and how do those get found?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible. I haven't really seen attacks that are using, I mean, there have been cases of it, but it's not very frequently occurring. I guess I'm slightly more concerned about you're ordering a device and it comes shipped with a certain firmware, and it has extra capabilities and or chips that maybe aren't being used in that particular firmware, but an attacker could utilize that for something else. I think back to when the Nest thermostats started becoming really popular, and some really smart security researcher took one apart and evaluated it. It was like, oh, this has a Zigbee chipset, but it's not using Zigbee. It was like there for future use, right? And so, I mean, you look at all the different circuit boards, there could certainly be chips on there that aren't being used right now, but through some kind of firmware update could be enabled.
True. That reminds me of our conversation with Scott Hoke a couple weeks ago with IPv6, because it was kind of like, we think we've disabled it, but it's not actually disabled. It's
right. Still there.
It's still there. It's still doing stuff.
It's still there.
Yeah. I love that interview too, because I'm in the camp of, I can just ignore IPv6 for the rest of my life, right? I keep being told it's going to be something I have to do. And then lo and behold, yeah, it's enabled on everything already.
My big question is, you know, if I'm your average network engineer or infrastructure engineer or server person, whatever, what am I meant to do with this information that there could be vulnerable firmware or vulnerable hardware out there? Because I feel like I'm buying it from a brand name company. Presumably they should be taking care of this. Where should this be sort of on my priority list of things to worry about? And then how would I address it?
Yeah, I think the number one thing, and it's really easy for me to sit here and say you should update your firmware, right? But that's probably, in everything we've talked about, the one remediation effort you should take away is have a process for continually updating firmware, just as you would for any other type of software, right? Do that often. Don't incur a lot of technical debt, just as I would recommend for, you know, web applications or developers. Constantly, you know, update that firmware, because most of the threats that I see are due to some vulnerability or misconfiguration inside of firmware, and a firmware update remediates that for sure. You know, the next thing is, you know, validating your firmware is a slightly more difficult step, because then it depends on, well, which firmware? Is it on your BMC inside of your server, or is it on your network switch or router? And how do you validate that? Because each manufacturer may have a different process for managing and validating that firmware. So that's a lot of what the problems that we try and solve at Eclipsium is, giving you one platform in order to validate that. I like to say that we have like this hoarding problem, where we like to hoard firmware. So we have like a database of millions of different samples of firmware, and we can compare that against it. And then my other recommendation is to take snapshots of your firmware to see if it changes, right? And so if you've got a device on your network and you can run something that says it's using this firmware, and then go check it tomorrow, and is it still running the same firmware or something different? And if it's different and you haven't applied an update, then that could be evidence that some tampering is happening.
This also makes me kind of wonder about the recent news of ransomware, malware gangs who are running those malware anonymity networks where they're taking over some of that ISP like customer equipment, the routers and things that are typically in homes and residential areas that are not managed by an enterprise network engineer or organization. Right. It just seems like those are Swiss cheese when it comes to security, and there's just vulnerabilities inside, outside, yes, left, right. What are your thoughts on that and us being good citizens and users of that, but also the manufacturer's role in that? Because one of the things I've been noticing is in talking to like even the Wi-Fi Alliance and the people in the swirl around that organization is it's, you know, I think of a lot of us in network engineering, you know, we think of the Wi-Fi as enterprise Wi-Fi with those vendors and technologies and use cases. But the truth is we're all eclipsed by the consumer market and they just don't give a about security, frankly. Like they're really doing us all a disservice. And now the fact that we have foreign adversaries using those and we have the US federal government, you know, trying to partially mitigate that, at least, you know, won't stay through a reboot. But what are your thoughts about that?
I think that IoT stands for Internet of Trash. And when we talk about consumer routers and firewalls, it's a really sad state of affairs when it comes to security. And the trend I'm seeing in this area is vulnerabilities are being discovered, exploits are being written and published for firmware versions and hardware that is unsupported by the manufacturer. And the manufacturers, I won't name any names, D-Link, TP-Link, will say, well, you're out of luck. Go buy a new device, right? And economically, that's in the favor of the manufacturers. Like, why would we support this stuff when we want people to go buy something new? So I'm very concerned that like things like Mirai are going to continue to grow, because if you look at older firmware that is now unsupported and you find a vulnerability, you know it will be there forever because it is unsupported. And so the attackers know this and they're bringing it into their tools so they can maintain their own attacker infrastructure using our commercial grade routers. I don't have a great solution for it, which is, you know, it comes up on a lot of interviews that I do too, right? Ones I'm conducting and ones where I'm being interviewed, it comes up all the time. And like for the consumer, there aren't great answers, right? We can evangelize and say, you should replace your router, but it's not gonna work.
Well, for the consumer stuff, do the ISPs have some role and responsibility in this? Like, should they be not letting home users continue to use busted crap for 10 years after it's not? Like, should they be more proactive in replacing that and also locking down the management interface?
Yeah, I mean, potentially. I think it was Japan that was doing something like that. They were actually scanning for vulnerabilities. Not sure if they were turning off people's systems or patching people's systems, but it was something. It seemed like a heavy hand, right? But they were being proactive about finding vulnerable devices in consumers that are attached to a consumer ISP. So it's an interesting approach. And we've talked about, you know, I've talked to my good friend Josh Corman, of course, about how we handle that in the medical space is with grant funding from the government to say these medical devices really have to be updated. And you know what, we'll help with some of that cost to get them updated. I don't know if a similar program could exist for consumers, but I think, you know, it's all infrastructure, how critical it is. You know, if we were to start threat modeling, what happens when people start attacking every single vulnerable router in the US? It could be a bad day.
I will note that the FCC recently rolled out sort of an official certification mark that can go on IoT devices that meet minimum security standards developed by NIST. It's a voluntary program. And JJ, this is probably a story we should dig into a little bit more. It just happened a couple weeks ago.
Oh, it's complete rubbish.
My immediate assumption was this sounds like some theater, but
I'm going to say their heart's in the right place. But in the South, I would say bless their little heart. Like it's a B plus for the thought and a C minus. I mean, they're doing probably all they know to do. It's better than nothing, but it's really more of a program that the manufacturers have to offer the consumer some education and a path to updating the IoT thing. You know, a lot of that is kind of cumbersome, especially on consumer, because that level of IoT type thing, we're talking about smart home things. You're talking about stuff that may eventually be on your Wi-Fi, but you've probably first connected to it to provision it with Bluetooth and a phone. It's its own mess. So yeah, we can go down that rabbit hole later. I'd love to see that program actually build into something meaningful.
Yeah, and I think that something meaningful has to enable people to easily replace their gear with something newer that's supported.
Yeah. This whole conversation hits home for me because, you know, obviously I've worked in the enterprise networking space for well over 20 years, but also it wasn't too long ago I had purchased a wireline link thing. So basically, you know, send data over the power.
Yes. Yeah. Like a rate. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was in a temporary place and using that to get network connectivity between two floors and realized that there was definitely traffic egressing, not to places that my normal traffic flow egressed to.
Yes.
So pulled that out pretty quickly. Now, Paul, I don't really have the tools nor the time nor the effort or energy to go pursue something like that. But on the enterprise side, what is the tooling like look like? You mentioned there are some tools to do things like that. You know, is this like a highly specialized skill set? How do people learn these? And or what are some of the offerings out there just in terms of like education, learning a little bit more about due diligence?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually have some blog posts on the Ecclesium site that talk about this. So I published a Linux firmware cheat sheet, like how to evaluate and collect firmware in Linux. And then I made an update to that, and I called it the Linux supply chain cheat sheet. So how do you interrogate your hardware and firmware on your Linux device to do the analysis? And then it was just published like an hour ago. I did the same thing for Android. So the Android tool set is actually slightly different, because if you can pull the apps off of an Android device, you can decompile them and look for things inside the code. For firmware, there's lots of different frameworks. You know, Binwalk has been a tool that's been around for a really long time. And it's basically a manual decompilation or disassembly of the firmware, looking for things like file systems. So if there's a file system in the firmware, you mount that file system. And then there's like this interesting crossover between that and forensics. So like I'm looking at this as if it was a compromised Linux system. So if you know, you study or you know stuff about forensics, you're going to have a great time coming in and like looking at reverse engineering firmware. And some of the tools are getting better. The Emba team is great. That's a tool that, you know, we spend a lot of time with internally evaluating, because they've just done a great job of automating a lot of the tasks that we would do manually with like another set of tools. And so there's lots of advances in this technology as well, including emulation. So the other thing is, if you don't have the actual device, but you can get the firmware for that device, and getting that firmware, if you've read some of the research recently, there's a lot of funny stories and references to things they don't necessarily want to publicize, because they're like, we have to say how we got this firmware, and let's just say it came from a friend, right? And sometimes that friend, or sometimes they'll call it out, sometimes that friend is, I forget the website, but it looks at all the open file sharing buckets and lets you search it. So if you plug firmware in there, you might find some firmware. And then one strategy is to run that firmware in emulation. So there's been some advances in the technology to actually run that firmware in emulation, which can be very time consuming. It can take months. If it's a firmware that hasn't been emulated, it can literally take months to figure out how to get that to run in emulation. So.
Yeah, one of our probably mutual friends showed me, is it Corellium recently for emulating Apple OS?
Yes, yes. I was like, why does that sound familiar? Yeah, that's for Apple devices. Yeah,
yeah, kind of blew my mind. But because they don't expose anything, it's kind of reverse engineered where, you know, that group has pushed.
Yes, that's the other annoying thing about, if I want to look inside of a firmware to see if it has any vulnerabilities, oftentimes we're encountering firmware that's encrypted by the manufacturer. And so what you'll also see in the research that's published out there is ways to decrypt said firmware, which is, I think, been pretty successful. I mean, maybe we're just publishing the ones that we can decrypt. And I say we as Ecclesium, but there's a lot of other, you know, companies, research groups that have done a great job of going, yeah, this firmware is encrypted. Here's how we decrypted it. And you know, I think there's lots of reasons why manufacturers want to like not ship an SBOM and encrypt their firmware, protecting intellectual property. If it has open source software in it and they haven't disclosed that, that could be some legal ramifications. If there's lots of vulnerabilities, now you've got regulations like the CRA in Europe that says you're not supposed to ship stuff that has known vulnerabilities. Well, we can look and find those. You know, that could be problematic. So the encrypting of firmware is super annoying.
So, Paul, last question before we wrap then. We are talking about hardware. Can I also just dig into the hardware and pull it apart, particularly if I'm going after firmware?
Yeah, absolutely. So much fun.
Paul has a slightly twisted idea of fun.
It is so much fun.
high six-figure firewall. It's a lot of fun for me to rip this open. And...
So I didn't do it with those. However, I wrote a blog post kind of summarizing and validating some of the Android TV research that had been published. And what folks discovered was if you go to Amazon and you just type in Android TV and you buy the first few things that come up in the list, if you start taking those apart, because they're cheap, right? It's like $35. So you can interface with the hardware, pull out the Android bits, and then figure out that it has been compromised already. So from the manufacturer, it had malware. So we call that pre-owned Android TV devices. And the hardware aspect of that was interesting because doing a couple of things, like you can clip directly onto the flash chip, and you can potentially pull data off of it. You can, one thing we did was actually use soldering techniques to remove the flash chip from the device and put that on a reader and read the image off of that, which was, that was a lot of fun. And then there's also like pinout headers for things like JTAG or UART for your serial access that I used to gain access to some of those devices. So interfacing with the hardware is sometimes like the way to go analyze the device. But again, it's very time consuming. You need a special set of tools, both hardware and software, and knowledge on how to do that.
I got a flipper recently and then went down some rabbit hole with pinouts for a couple of things. And I was like, no, like 3 hours later, I feel like I'm 12 years old again. We just need more hours in the day for curiosity. That's all.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Well, Paul, thank you for being with us. This was a cool conversation, and I think maybe we have given folks something else to add to their list, but that's fine because that's why we're here. So thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening to another episode of Packet Protector. You can find us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want more nerdy goodness on networking, wireless, cloud, network automation, and more, go to packetpushers.net, where you'll find thousands of hours of free technical content for your listening pleasure.